Kathy, how are members of the nation involved in the archaeological project?
The proposal and the actual project that we've been collaborating on the last three summers, it routinely is submitted after Steve and I kind of do the initial drafting, and very much the most part with Steve and my input, is submitted to our tribal council for approval. And then if they have any recommendations for changes as far as protocol or how they would communicate their progress to the community or special events, they would get that input in. We'd make the changes, and then it's formally approved, the project's formally approved by the tribal council and communicated to our tribal community.
Okay.
And as far as input, I'm designated a historic preservation advisor from the tribal government, so that I would have to oversee the program. And then we have a member who is the tribal historic preservation officer who would be on grounds daily with the project.
Are there any community members digging in the ground and doing that whole thing?
Actually, we have about two or three every summer that are actually digging in the ground with the students from UMass, and it's been quite an experience for them. And I think it has been really beneficial on both sides. But you're right, it took a while to get to this point as far as archaeology and collaboration, because for many years, Native peoples and Indigenous peoples were just not included.
Right.
And the archaeologists just came onto their lands, took what wasn't theirs, went to their labs or their museums and put it on the shelf. And actually, I had a real chilling experience when I went to the Smithsonian Museum. I was working in Washington, and I was doing some study up in the archives at Natural History. And one of the interns gave me a little tour and showed me some of the bones that had been taken from some place either in the United States or South America. But as part of the NAGPRA, they were repatriating it back to the land because of the federal law.
Right.
So the federal law, the NAGPRA legislation that came in 1990, has forced archaeologists to, assist in getting those artifacts back to Indigenous people, and also it's forced them to consult with Native tribes formally, with their governments, to interpret or to make sure that these artifacts go to their land. And that's been very helpful, I think.
Tell me some of the things that you folks have found. And I'm sort of curious, too, about whether the same artifact has the same importance for the nation as it has for you, Stephen.
Well, I'll start with the easy question of some of the things that we've found. What we've tried to do for the last three field seasons, the fourth one coming up, is to get a sense of what kinds of archaeological sites are on the reservation, kinds of cultural sites. It's done a lot, required a lot of mapping and investigation, and what we've found thus far are a number of houses, or what the remnants of houses, that seem mostly to date to the late 1700s and the early to middle 1800s. A particular time in Eastern Pequot Reservation history that we've been able to look at. So probably somewhere between about 1760 and 1840 to 1850. We've excavated portions of a few of these houses, and within those we find a number of things, animal bones from, different meals of various sorts, pipes, clay pipes, ceramics, metal objects like nails, shoe buckles, buttons, those kinds of things, a lot of glass from either windows in the houses or actual, vessels of some sort, whether they're bottles or whatnot. And these houses are built in a way that has parallels to the Europeans and Euro-Americans in that vicinity, because the houses that we've looked at thus far either have partial cellars, they were some kind of a framed style house with a chimney. But what we know is also during the early, at least as late as the early 1800s, there were some Eastern Pequot community members living in more traditional structures. These are very difficult to find archaeologically, so every year we're kind of circling around with the archaeological techniques to try to find some of these kinds of structures. And if you go back to the late 1600s when the reservation was established, everyone was living in those kinds of structures. So we're still in the search on that reservation for those kinds of things.
What makes it difficult to find them?
The frame-style houses, you know, if someone digs a cellar and then they have a chimney and the rocks all fall over, that leaves a pretty big footprint mm-hmm. on the landscape. The more traditional structures, often called wigwams or weetus, are saplings that are, you know, stuck into the ground, tied at the top in sort of a dome or a conical sort of shape. And what happens is there's often not much as much ground preparation that happens
right.
with those, and
mm-hmm.
then when they collapse, if they're not taken down, it tends to decay, and then everything, because there's not a lot of
yeah,
rocks associated
right,
necessarily.
Right. Yeah, that's
so you have to find certain kinds of artifacts or portions of a hearth, you know, fireplace
right,
of
right.
sorts to do that. And so that's been one of the challenges, is trying to locate the slightly earlier things
right.
on the reservation. We know they're there. I mean, the documents talk about it. Tribal history talks about it. I mean, that's when the reservation was established. That's been a little bit more difficult to find. But even in the context, we occasionally find portions of stone tools. Some of these might have been used in the 18th or 19th century, but we occasionally find other ones that are several thousand years old that show a, you know, long-term native use of that landscape, usually, you know, like a spear point or
right, right.
an arrow point or something like that. Those kinds of things do show up from time to time as well.
Kathy, what have been the most interesting finds for you?
Yeah, I think the earlier, and we kind of have this debate sometimes because... you know, having one of the oldest reservations in the nation, and myself and some of the other members of the tribe are very much interested in trying to go back as far as
sure.
possible to find those stone tools. And we've located he calls them a projectile, stone projectile point or something.
Right.
We call it an arrowhead. We find an arrowhead, we're like, an arrowhead, you know? And they're like, this is, oh, we found a stone projectile point or something, right?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the general term for spear points, arrow points, dart points. That's just our, like, general term for that.
Right. Yeah. So I get more excited with the stone tools, and I think some of the native people do, too, because then it takes you back further
sure.
to your
yeah.
ancestors. And the adornment types of things. If I find a piece
oh,
of copper
yeah.
with a hole in it, that might could be used for a necklace or
right.
an earring, and I, you know, hold up, I could have worn
yeah,
that, you know.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
really connects me to the ancestors, those
that,
type of things.
That really must be so exciting to... You know, to hold your past in your hand like that.
Yes, it is. And people have said when they come to our reservation, whether they're native people or non-native, that I guess because the majority of the land there, it's approximately 225 acres that we have now, is undeveloped. They walk down into, as soon as they walk through the path to the woods, because it's all unpaved roads,
mm-hmm.
they really get a sense of this is a really a spiritual, sacred mm-hmm, place. Mm-hmm. And you can almost feel yourself going back in time and being close to Mother Earth and native
yeah,
culture
yeah.
because the land still is very pristine. And even though there's been small patches that we've developed for very special events, you can feel the spirit of the land,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
That's very special to us. And because we've had a very open collaboration, and there's a lot of work done during the field seasons, and a lot of the ground surface is opened up, at the end of this 5 weeks, it's back in place, and you never knew that anyone had been there before. So they really do an excellent job, and that's, I think, why it's been very successful.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
That they have, Steve has encouraged the students that work on the project to respect the land as we do, and the collaboration is working very well.
Right. Would you be putting everything back the way it was if you were just any old archaeologist doing on any old site. I mean, is that standard procedure?
It's fairly standard. I mean, it depends on the kind of project. And there's some projects where things are left open because they're going to be developed.
Back, right,
yeah, yeah, somebody's going to come. Or are you coming back the next year? And so you just decide to cover it with a little bit of plastic and come back and clean it up later. So there's a little bit more effort on our part to make sure that things are covered up nicely. And it helps in a forested landscape because we can spread the leaves out and, kind of minimize what it looks like or what kind of disturbance we might have done.
Kathy, now, this is certainly a very hypothetical question because, you know, it's clear that you guys have developed a good relationship and that there is, you know, trust between you. But how do you know he hasn't carted off something that you don't know about?
Right. Actually, and that's well-founded, and that was some of the concern from some of the tribal counselors. You know, you might like this guy, but I don't know anything about him. I don't trust that he might put something in his pocket
right.
and slip off with it. How do you know that he doesn't have an arrowhead to up at you messing with? Anyway, because we do have that historic preservation officer, we did set up a protocol where he has to, along with Dr. Selman, document the number of bags that of artifacts or soil that they have identified in a particular location. And our historic preservation officer confirms that
I see.
With Dr. Silliman every day.
Okay.
And then that's brought back to the council. And then the historic preservation officer actually has to see them, the bag, count the bags, and, you know, verify that everything is as it's written.
And that's been an interesting component.
I was going to ask you, I mean,
it's very interesting because it's a different level. Yeah, it's a different level. You know, at the one level you have the, okay, we're going to do the tobacco offerings and the opening orientation, all the things that, you know, sort of speak to the collaboration.
Right.
And then there are the other elements that are kind of like, I don't want to call them surveillance, but they're...
Why
The things that are in place, you know, to ensure trust. And I remember the first time Kathy mentioned it to me, I thought, wow, am I professionalism being called into question? Not that Kathy, but, you know, there's a series of archaeological ethics that the profession is supposed to abide by. And one of those is, you know, you don't run off with things and you don't steal things and you document them fully and all that. So I knew
yeah,
that I was
right.
doing that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. How well has that worked in the past?
Right, exactly.
Exactly.
And some of these ethics statements are pretty new.
Okay.
So I knew that obviously I wasn't going to run off with anything, but I thought, well, this is interesting because it's a mechanism that's now in place so that everyone can feel good about what's going forward. Because what became obvious was, there were so many things I just assumed about that people would know about archaeology, and it was clear that Kathy and other people didn't know them, just like there were many things we had to learn about what is it like to be on the Eastern Pequot Reservation, what is it like to do this with a different kind of cultural sensitivity. So it was clear that what these kinds of requests, whether on their part or on mine, were doing was opening a dialogue. So that then we could talk about, and actually the way it first, it was interesting, the way it first happened was I sign a waiver at the beginning that says, you know, I'm going to do certain things that are, you know, these are for the benefit of the tribe. And one of the lines in the contract basically said, nothing will be removed from the reservation, which, you know, for contractors and other kinds of people makes perfect sense. And I saw that line and I thought, huh.
This could be a problem.
How are we going to make this? So I asked Kathy, I said, should I just like strike that out? And she's like, well, I don't know. What does it mean for you? Do you need to take stuff? And how much do you need to take? So it initiated this dialogue about this is what that normally we would take things, you know, take them back to the lab because we spend the whole year cleaning and processing. And the field time there in the summer is really the time to actually spend the time on the land and trying to acquire as much information as we can so it can be processed later. And that's what then developed into the, okay, well, you should count all the artifacts before you go. each day. And then that's when we had to discuss this, because sometimes we may pull out 300 artifacts, 500, 600 artifacts. There may be, you know, 200 pieces of little bits of animal bone or shellfish, and the logistics of accounting every single piece in the field would have, like, put us to an absolute standstill. So that's when we negotiated the bag count. Mm-hmm. The bag would say the kinds of things that are in it, mm-hmm. but not an exact count, but mm-hmm. we would know how much generally had come out of each hole that we had right. dug, and then the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer is there to, you know, watch what people are doing and spend time with. So it was an interesting dialogue and negotiation that we were able to do, as we both learned from each other and then realized we can do this in a way that everybody actually benefits from.
Right, right. Well, now, but Kathy, what ultimately happens to what's found? I mean, Stephen has said, you know, he'll take it back to the lab and, you know, do things to it. But when that's done, then what happens?
Well, right now they are acting as our temporary, I would say, conservation unit mm-hmm. for the artifacts, because we don't have a place set up within our community center that can house and preserve the artifacts the way they should be. So the UMass has a temporary facility for that. We did require that anything that was not identified as an artifact, that was still just soil or rock, come back to the reservation. So that was another burden, unexpected
burden.
Yeah,
that was a very interesting dimension. Because most of the time in the lab, because it invariably happens in the field, students are excavating, they're like, well, maybe that's an artifact, I'll throw that in the bag. And you get back to the lab, people open it up, and it's just a bunch of rocks.
Right.
Well, not a bunch of rocks. I mean, students are quite good at what they do, but occasionally they don't know. And normally in an archaeology lab, those things are pulled out of the bag, you throw them in the trash.
Uh-huh.
And this was a whole new dimension where now everything goes back. Even the really amazing sort of logistical thing that we have to do is we take a large bags of dirt, bring them back to the lab because we want to use them, what's called flotation. We run them through a agitated water machine, and then plant remains will float. You scoop them off the top because you can't really find them very well when you're digging. All that dirt that kind of goes through the machine and ends up with mud at the end, we have to put that aside, dry it in these containers, and then ultimately
take it back to the reservation.
Yes, which is really interesting.
Do you have to take it back to where you got that bag of dirt from?
No.
Or just somewhere?
Yeah, somewhere.
Well, see, she's cut you slack, man.
Right.
You should
exactly.
be grateful.
Exactly, that's right.
I think it's been a very workable compromise.
Yeah, right.
That is quite fascinating. But it sounds like ultimately you intend to have the artifacts housed at the reservation.
We do. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at some options of, what we might be able to set up because we're starting to acquire quite a collection of artifacts, and what we've done so that the council and community are aware. Steve will give a presentation and bring in samples of the types of artifacts that are located. And he's really done some really nice presentations, PowerPoint presentations, and then actual hands-on, so they can actually look and touch the artifacts and see that they're being well-maintained and at the same time enlightened about some of the types of things that we're finding. So it's working out quite well right now.
And having them here has been useful because a lot of the graduate students, they're doing master's thesis projects on them, where they're analyzing them here and writing up a thesis so that we can get more research done on them for their sake as well.
Right. Are there any folks from the nation involved in the lab work?
Unfortunately, at this point, no. Mm. I mean, it's a 100-mile distance.
Oh, right, of course. I keep forgetting that.
That's a bit more challenging. Yeah. We're trying to figure out some ways, and actually Kathy's presence here today is an opportunity. We're actually going to go to the lab in a little while, so she can see more of what that looks like and how it goes forward. And I have some ideas about how we might fix some of this, make this even a more transparent thing down the line. But
Kathy, have you had to, or do you anticipate that you will have to develop any special rituals or ceremonies for the archaeological project? I mean, you talked about the tobacco and the smudging, but these are fairly traditional that you do for other things
That's
as well.
That's right.
So is there anything that was done or that you think may have to be done in the future just for this project?
As we're kind of modifying, it's evolving. And, you know, we do have to kind of share our as much as the members are willing to share the cultural beliefs beside the rituals and perspectives on indigenous life, indigenous cultures and beliefs, because we're finding that our perspectives are really different on how you might look at an object or view a particular historical situation. And that comes from your frame of reference and your background, your experience, how you might interpret a situation. So I think we're finding that we have to do more open discussions on as the project evolves.
Kathy, what will happen if accidentally some remains are found?
We did set up a protocol that if remains are found, they are to cease immediately from performing their archaeological techniques, and then the historic preservation officer will contact the council, the tribal council, and then the tribal council will either send a delegation or they will go out to the site and then determine what should happen next. It would probably be that we would ask them to go to work in another location,
right,
because there's a possibility that it might be part of a burial ground site on our reservation. And we know that there are some areas of the reservation that do have burial grounds that are covered, that we don't know exactly where they are.
Right.
So that would be the protocol. And in the last three summers, we have not come across any of the human remains or burial grounds, and they know generally where they are, and we try to keep away from those areas for the project.
Yeah, we designed the kind of the what we call subsurface survey, which is digging in small holes at regular intervals just to see if we can find sites or the edges of sites.
Right.
And we make sure with all these known burial grounds that we never get within a certain distance of those, just in case there are a few unmarked ones that are, you know, near the marked ones. So we, you know, but we've also tried to help map some of these areas a little bit better for their management needs.
Okay.
I think there's collectively as a project, but then also as archaeologists and other people, we confront this difficulty. It's in New England and it's everywhere in the United States that there are some people who, and I mean by some people, sometimes archaeologists, but also general public, politicians, whatever the case might be, have a certain perception of what Native Americans are supposed to look like, the kinds of things they're supposed to use, the kinds of houses they were supposed to have lived in. And I think what's interesting is we're on this reservation, we are excavating 18th, 19th century Eastern Pequot households, yet if you were to lift these up and put them off the reservation, if someone's not paying attention, they would say, oh, that's a European-style house. Look, they're using porcelain and nails and glass bottles. But then the Eastern Pequot have been using some of these for, you know, these families probably been using these kinds of, quote, so-called European artifacts for a century.
Sure.
By the time we find them, and to me, those are Eastern Pequot artifacts. But there's a tendency to say, oh, those are European artifacts. Well, that might be their ultimate origin, but that's not the way they're lived. And so, therefore, they are part of Eastern Pequot, and it's part of that sort of trajectory that leads the community where it is today. And I think we battle this quite a bit, the claims about what's authentic and what's not. And
right. It seems a kind of naive assumption that two peoples can live next door to each other and not exchange anything.
Yeah.
That's right. You don't live in isolation.
Right.
Yeah. And then also, I mean, nobody looks back to 18th century Euro-American United States and acts like, well, there's this assumption that, well, as different as Euro-Americans were in, you know, 1780 versus now, well, that's just because we changed and became still who we are. But people look back at 18th century native communities and say, well, maybe you were kind of Indian there, but now you're not so much
right,
now.
Right,
but there's
right,
a
right.
loss of this, that they think that everybody can change except
yes.
Native Americans, even though there was this all these efforts to try to change them in the
right.
18th, 19th, 17th century. So there's this weird paradox that's at work.
And of course, it only goes, you know, one way. You know, I mean, you don't become Native American because you eat corn pudding, but you,
right.
you know, you do become a non-Native if you live in a Western-style house.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Right. It's not like the Irish became Peruvian because they started eating potatoes.
Right. Exactly. And I think a lot of people miss the point, and that's why we're proud to say that the reservation, as it stands as a reservation that was established for a community of Native people, was during colonial times in 1683, and it's that same land that I have my relatives living on today.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most essential things that we need to keep saying to people, and that there is a community of people, still Native people, that are still attached, living, dying, and having ceremonies and in life events on this
same,
particular
right,
part of land
right, right.
And
as
that
a community. It is in many ways just an absolutely anti-U.S. concept in which, you know, people move every 5 years and, you know, don't know who their great-grandparents were.
Exactly.
And, you know, sort of live on the top of the land only,
right.
in a sense, you know, so.
And then also, but the interesting spin on all that is most of those people don't have anybody questioning who they are.
Right.
Either.
Exactly. Precisely.
And I think that's
yes. Well, because they're the default group.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. They don't have to. You don't have to prove that you're this group or that group
yeah.
until
yeah.
you're a Native American,
right.
and then there's yeah. this other standard that's there.
But now there's a big question coming up against about immigrants.
Yes.
So that would be an interesting
yes.
spin for Native people.
That's true. That's very true.
Yes, well, it's ever interesting times in the U.S. of A.
That's true. But
right.
then I did think of sort of a specific example our culture and our perception versus non-Native. And I think we talked about it a little bit when we request Steve to bring back the soil
oh, yes.
to the land. And that is because the perception is that the land, if it's not something valuable that I can count in dollars and cents or that I can put in my lab and say, oh, I found this, then it has no value, say, to the archaeologist. But to the Native person, that soil or that rock is Mother Earth. And that's what our life is rooted to, Mother Earth, our spiritual beliefs are rooted to Mother Earth, so we want to keep that intact as much as possible. And
you don't throw it in the trash.
Yeah, don't throw it in the trash. So, you know, there's that American belief that, you know, if it's not a value system,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that is challenged, that perspective is challenged when you're working with the land and
yeah,
Native
yeah.
people.
One of the most stimulating things is changing the way that I teach. Although, because this is a field school situation, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that every season we go through this, I really change the sort of the pedagogy of what I'm, of how I'm doing this, and what we're talking about in the field, and spending more time in a field school where people are learning techniques and, you know, how to dig, how to use a line level, how to fill out a form, but we're also talking about colonialism and identity and these kinds of things that are, you know, really makes you think differently when you're using that trowel and digging.
Right, right, right.
It adds a whole new dimension
yeah, yeah.
to that.
Yeah, I can see that it would, you know, that it is much more holistic way of looking at, you know, your work than, you know, just getting it out of the ground and into the lab as fast as you can and writing a paper about it.
Right.
Speaking of writing, though, there ultimately is going to be a book out of this, isn't there?
I would hope so. What the kind of progression of projects, generally speaking, is that usually a few articles come out that summarize, and then after a few years, it's all synthesized in a book form. The interesting dynamic is that anything that I publish, or the very fact that I can present on this at conferences has taken place in a discussion with Kathy and Tribal Council to make sure that they're comfortable mm-hmm. with some of this kinds of information becoming public. So one of the first ways we've done this, other than giving, I give talks at conferences or local kinds of venues, but one of the things is this chapter that we're doing about the process of doing uh-huh. the collaborative project. And then I hope in the near future, I and some others can do articles and, like, you know, journals and other sure. things that summarize some of the kinds of things that are happening and maybe leading up to other kinds of publications. Because I think we're all, Kathy and I and everyone on council, and I think we're generally committed to making this stuff known mm-hmm. publicly, because these are interesting and valuable histories that I think everyone would benefit from knowing something about. And of course, that's different than sort of publishing a map that says, here are all the sites on the reservation, you know, and that's a security issue right there. But in terms of talking about these histories, I think we share a general commitment to mm-hmm. making those somewhat public.
Great. Good, good.